Everyone, welcome back to the Burn Bag Podcast. I'm Andrea, and I am joined here by Matthew McKnight, General Manager of Biosecurity at Ginkgo Bioworks. Hi, Matt. How are you doing today?
Hey, Andrea. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no, we're really excited to speak with you. So just before we kick things off, who are you? Let's fill the audience in. What do you do and what exactly, you know, piqued your interest slash led you to working in biosecurity?
Yeah, sure. That's a big question with a lot of angles to it. You know, today, very directly, I'm general manager for biosecurity at Ginkgo Bioworks. Ginkgo Bioworks is a 1,200 person company based in Boston. We trade on the New York Stock Exchange under the ticker DNA, which for a bunch of people that run the company who are from the Jurassic Park era, you know, we're very proud of. And about 1,000 of those people work in what we call our cell engineering platform. That's about 300,000 square feet here in Boston of capabilities we have built to engineer biology, to really make amazing products out of biotechnology. And I can get into that in a bit more, but think about the business model a lot like what AWS and the cloud does for the app ecosystem. You know, you've got cloud infrastructure that powers all these different apps, whether they be dating apps or enterprise apps. You've got this back-end infrastructure. What Ginkgo does as a business on the kind of like economic productivity side is really power a lot of genetic engineering apps. So you might think of those as amazing medicines, but they're also things that create new materials and food proteins and fertilizers, all made out of genetically engineered products. So that's really the 1,000 people of the company. And if folks come visit, it's really a pretty amazing thing to see here out by Logan Airport in Boston. And then there are 200 of us that lead have built over the last 4 years what we call biosecurity. And the way to think about that is we've been taking these modern tools of biotech and applying them towards the challenge that we've all witnessed with COVID, but certainly that we also see coming around security issues in biology broadly. Those can be natural issues, but also as we enter this new era of bioengineering and this area, this kind of world where bioengineering and AI and other computational powers are converging, we see a new threat surface emerging. And we believe that companies like ours need to be building capabilities to help governments around the world defend against bio threats writ large. So we're really, I think, the largest kind of dedicated company focused on building the tools of biosecurity and biodefense with those 200 folks.
I feel like I already have a million questions, but I think just to provide a little bit of context, you know, around biological threats and kind of that space, you know, thinking of national security, obviously the first thing that comes to mind perhaps for you is biological security, but, you know, people think direct war or, you know, other threats that perhaps are a little bit more visible than biological or let's say chemical threats. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how biological threats to national security have evolved over time? Did this look a little bit different in the last century, perhaps Cold War era versus now that we see everything that happened with COVID? Predicting other events similar to COVID, how does that differ? And, you know, I assume biological threats, of course, have been present for centuries, millennia, you have it. So, you know, would love to know a little bit more.
Yeah, Andrea, this is a really important point. Okay, so I'm a history major.
Oh, perfect.
This is a
perfect question to perfect person to ask.
Right. Well, this is why we are so passionate about what we're building here, because there's two big buckets to think about. One, you look at the course of human history. Biology, both in warfare and just in civilizational change, has clearly been the most powerful force, right? It has been the force, whether you look at the plagues or you look at its impact on conflict. My favorite example is the Louisiana Purchase, which people might remember is the United States buying a giant swath of what became the Midwest, essentially, and the South from France, because the French army couldn't make it off of Haiti because of outbreaks of infectious disease. And ultimately, the fallback option was just to sell what they meant to occupy to the United States, right? And that's a biology-driven geopolitical force. So it's clearly been the most powerful force in human history. Now, I think the really important thing to think about where we are today, what is different, is not that there haven't been amazing human beings in the Defense Department, in the intelligence community, in public health, addressing these problems, but we're in a different moment right now. And give me 30 seconds to give you a sense of that different moment. The way to think about this is going back to the beginning of the 20th century. Since the beginning of the 20th century, we have taken every subject of high school science and turned it from experimental science into an engineerable discipline where humans can actively control and use it. We started with chemistry in the early 1900s. We created chemical engineering. It turned the barrel of oil into everything around us. Physics in the 1930s gave us this like amazing new capabilities with electrical engineering and ultimately our ability to fly airplanes and launch satellites. And that was the merger then in the late 20th century, where chemistry and physics came together to give us the computer chip, right? Electrical engineering plus material science. And we've had this accelerating curve of technological innovation kind of building on each of those steps. Well, there's only one domain of high school science left that we haven't turned into a truly human controllable discipline, and that's biology. And it's this amazing force. It's the most powerful force. It makes everything on the planet. And it is crazily, it runs on digital code in the form of DNA. That's the Jurassic Park 101. A, T, C, and G powers all of living things on this planet. And it's the same, essentially the same chemical compound, whether you're a plant, an animal, or a bacteria, or a human. And so I'll pause there. I do want to come back to this, but if you think about economic expansion, all of these technologies have been built for productive aspiration, but then each time they have been also used in human conflict. And so I think where I am today with bioengineering clearly becoming one of the defining features of the next 50 years, we ignore history at our own peril. Not to recognize that it is highly likely that bad actors use biology in some way, shape, or form in its engineerable form going forward in human conflict. Now, there's a lot of things we can do about that, which we'll talk about, but we have to start from a premise that we are at this kind of inflection point around engineered biology, and we can actually learn from what has happened in other categories of science in the past.
No, I love how you kind of juxtapose, there are so many opportunities or so many things that we can do with biological science, but also, there potentially are adversaries that are using biological weapons as threats. I feel like, I don't know, I would love to learn a little bit more just from your perspective. What biological threats from adversaries do we face nowadays? Is that just, I don't know, because you don't typically think of something, especially during COVID, just thinking about how everyone, well, for the most part, came together, the international community, countries around the world, efforts to stop this. It feels like biological science and just kind of the engineering around that is more of a unifier and less of a, this country is attacking this other country. Do you also share that perspective, or is just, biological threats from another country not necessarily talked about as much?
Yeah, so it's interesting. First and foremost, you're entirely right. Certainly, from a Ginkgo perspective, a perspective from me as a human being, the reason we are in this era and in this area of genetic engineering is because we believe in the massive productive capacity of engineered biology, right? These are the tools that are going to help us address climate change at scale. These are the tools that are going to help us address food insecurity at scale, right? Humans have always innovated their way out of challenges by creating new productive things. And that is the foundation of what Ginkgo does. So then on the other side, when we look at it, our mission as a platform company in biology, when we say we want to make biology easier to engineer, we also are implicitly saying we care how that platform is used. One of the things we need to do is invest in the security tools. So then we start with asking, what would those threats be? And actually, I'll come back to the nation state or rogue actor threat, which we do see increasing over time. But really, the start point is there's kind of three big categories that we need to worry about. And the new U.S. Department of Defense Bio Defense Posture Review talks about these. The UK launched a very, very good biological security strategy that also kind of uses the same framework. We think about threats as natural, man-made, or mistake. But the important thing is it's not a select list. It's not like it's only this or only that. It is essentially threats could come from anywhere at any time. And because biology does not respect borders, we need to think about defense infrastructure in the context of these types of pathogenic threats that could emerge from many different locations. So I worry, if you want to like put it in order, I kind of worry most still about natural threats emerging. There's lots of different ways to think about that, but you certainly still have issues with flu, which could be a very dangerous threat service as climate change exposes. You read articles about new ecosystems being exposed. I think we will face increasing natural threats. The second major one that I personally worry the most about is actually this explosion in research globally. There's something like over 150 labs around the world at the BSL-4 level, which is like the most secure level, doing experimentation on dangerous viruses and bacteria with the intent of learning about them to create mitigation tools, vaccines, and therapeutics. But just by doing that work, you do certainly increase the potential risk, not maybe even a mistake, but also, I was spending some time listening over the years to other Burn Bag podcasts. Like, there are bad actors even within those communities that could create new threat surfaces just by having access to these types of pathogens, right? And so I think what we're emerging into is this new era where we have to be kind of persistently and pervasively watching. And I can talk about how we think about the technology stack for that, but watching for threats wherever they emerge at all times, because it's no longer something you can just regulate your way out of in this new era of bioengineering.
Yeah, you mentioned a little bit the National Biodefense Strategy. So it's interesting because, of course, we put out national security strategies, whatnot, and the National Biodefense Strategy is something I stumbled upon while researching for this episode. And they did mention, agricultural resources, critical infrastructure, those are national priorities, kind of to protect against biological threats. What does resilience look like when we're thinking of protecting those resources? And I guess, with the work that you do at Ginkgo, how does that look like? Are you talking
Yeah.
frequently with, policymakers?
I think this is a really important point because we learn a lot from other defensive models. And I should say, like, there's resilience. Okay, so we learn a lot from other defensive models, and I think it's a really neat way to think about it. People often forget that it's not just cyber defense, right? And you all spend a lot of time talking about this. Cyber resilience is like a very important concept. The idea that you can operate in a contested space, right? So it is a little bit too much to think that in the very near term we would be able to kind of create pure, clean cyber or biodefense, right? Events will happen. The question is, are we resilient to be able to operate through different types of moments where we might face a bio threat? So I think that's it's a good framing, and we do look a lot to cyber as a model. So what we work with and what we see in the Biodefense Posture Review, and I do want to come back to talk about that in a second, because I think it was a really well done document that Dr. Brandy Van out of DoD led. You really need to think about biodefense in a way that has about 1,000x more aspiration than we do today, and think about it as a technology solve, kind of defense tech for biology. And what that looks a lot like is persistent pervasive detection, which people talk about as early warning. They talk about it as biosurveillance. But I think it's really important to think about it as the foundation being the world operates in this crazy way where genetic code of bacteria and viruses and other dangerous things, as well as things that are good, plants and animals and humans, it's like it's a massive high fidelity information source. Like, I always joke, like, the movie The Matrix should have been made out of like ATCs and Gs floating around, because it's actually how the world operates. And over the last 20 years, we've created the ability via the DNA sequencer to take snapshots of this massive new high fidelity information source, of DNA and RNA of planets. So when we of the planet, when we talk about persistent pervasive monitoring, think about it like monitoring nodes in the cyber infrastructure world. Every phone, every network operation center, every server is monitored 99.9% of the time. There's nothing bad happening in the zeros and ones, but we're always looking for that anomaly so that you can immediately find it before it infects entire networks, so that you can then characterize and prioritize the threat and serve it up for patching. That's exactly the way to think about a biodefense infrastructure that would be really scaled. So monitor locations where you think biothreats emerge from. We have a program with the CDC, as well as a number of international countries where we're monitoring airports. When airplanes land at seven airports in the US, we actually pull wastewater off of the planes and put that wastewater onto DNA sequencers and read what pathogens are in that wastewater. Non-human,
Wow.
privacy-centric. We now have a map. It's a start point of what's coming through, like a start point of a weather map. That's one example of monitoring. And then this is the second step is where, you know, this revolution in AI reading DNA will come in, where you now have DNA sequence data. It's very complex data. It is very hard to read. Today, it is like you have to have PhDs trained in bioinformatics and computational biology, leveraging really complex software tools to even understand what comes off of a DNA sequencer. But tomorrow, we signed a $200 million deal with Google Cloud to start continue to develop these tools. We're thinking about how do you leverage the capacity of generative AI to start interpreting what is coming off of these sequencers to do threat detection, right? That will make it an automated process of finding novel threats, not so different than cyber. And then what you do is you enable where we put most of our money and investment in the kind of large-scale public health, defense, and just pharmaceutical industry, then that data enables mitigations, whether those are policy mitigations or more appropriately from a technology standpoint, vaccine and therapeutic development. So it's really a stack that is not reinventing the wheel. We just need to like think about this like a defense problem, persistent pervasive monitoring, automated characterization, prioritization of those threats to enable patching, or in other language, right, like defense effectors. We want to stop what is happening. That system, the aspiration to build that system, it should be kind of like where we're focusing. And you see in the Biodefense Posture Review and the UK strategy start like it's pushing towards that. And it's really neat to see it pushing towards that.
Yeah, no, that's really cool. And I love how you kind of segued a little bit into the paper that Ginkgo had a commentary on biointelligence that I did want to talk about. But before we go into that, I did have a question on what you were kind of discussing and talking a little bit more about now. So you mentioned that one of the risks of, you know, biological monitoring is, you know, having these very dangerous viruses and whatnot, perhaps, I don't know, be in the hands of bad actors or just be tested in the wrong way. And then you also mentioned AI and its potential in working with, you know, developing biological technology for mitigating threats. Is there, and, you know, I feel like with AI and especially to testing that we don't know about, you always hear kind of it paired with ethics or ethical implications, whatnot. How does that look in the grand scheme of things? And how does, I guess, your perception of, you know, the testing that perhaps the high level testing that perhaps other actors are doing versus kind of the benefits of, you know, other things such as AI and biological technology development?
Okay,
That's a
so
loaded
the
question.
no,
I'm
it's a
sorry.
perfect question, because like, and this is like core to who we are at Ginkgo. Like, lots of people want to avoid these questions. We have to, as a society, we have to address these questions head on, right? Like, whether you're an AI platform, you know, in the kind of common lexicon today, what you're doing, you know, building LLMs, or you're a company like Ginkgo or others building AI tools for biology, like, these are powerful technologies. And if we aren't asking questions, if we aren't building new systems to like do both self-governance and group governance, like we are going to find ourselves in the place that none of us want to be. So like, let me give you the way to think about this, like both the product, I'll give you two things, the productive side and the kind of contrasting potential dangers, but really the way to think about how to quantify the risk of AI plus bio, right? So, like the really critical thing to remember, which is different mostly than, say, cyber or just general misinformation, disinformation, kind of threats that come from human language, LLMs, is that with bio, you can only do harm if you make a physical product. And you can only create, an amazing thing if you make a physical product. So actually, the digital to physical choke point is the most critical. And so you can design all the things you want with biological design tools, kind of the one of the colloquial names for using AGI and bio design. You can reduce, you can kind of give science, give individual humans all of the human language LLM results you want about how to build bioweapons, or frankly, how to build cool products. But if those people don't have the skills or access to laboratory infrastructure, then they can't actually do harm. And so the way to, like, if you're thinking about like a systems approach to both governing the productive uses and making sure the productive uses are conducted in a safe and responsible manner, which we have to do as a country because, and as a world, because this is where the economic competition of the future and where the opportunity to create a dramatically different set of useful resources for humanity will come from. That's the productive use of biology. But also, if you're worried about threats, like, you have to think about that lab infrastructure and the digital physical interface being where you have a chance to build ethical controls, caring controls, and technical controls. And so I can go into more detail there, but as we think about it, when we're looking at AI and bio, on the defensive side, the biosecurity side, we spend a lot of time in the human language LLM world as kind of subject matter experts helping to ensure that those models are not returning results that would help a researcher that does have access to the lab do something they wouldn't otherwise be able to do, right? So that's about lowering the barrier to information, but they still have to have access. And on the biological design tool side, I think the most exciting stuff to date is still building these tools. Like, we have a program at Ginkgo called, a product at Ginkgo called ENDAR. And that ENDAR is a tool that leverages computational methodologies, AI, and machine learning to look at sequence data to detect signs of genetic engineering. So we're using the biological design tool capabilities in reverse to detect things that might be generated by either somebody making a mistake and releasing something they shouldn't have, or by an actual bad actor. But I think it's really important for people as they start to think about what does it mean to understand bioengineering opportunities and threats, AI, where it fits, to remember that there's a lot of fear-mongering out there, but at the end of the day, where we need to be building capabilities is at this kind of fulcrum point between digital and physical.
Wow. I'm just here wondering, you know, you went from history to so much expertise in biology, trying to understand everything. Just a quick question, just out of curiosity myself. So the controls that you talked about, is that mostly the responsibility of private companies, or, you know, how regulated is it on the government side of things?
Yeah, I think a lot about this question. I think you kind of have to start with the big picture, which is we already live in a nation state driven world, and we live in an increasingly fractured world. And so I think first and foremost, the premise we have to start with is that it is the government's responsibility to provide biosecurity and biodefense capabilities, and then groups of governments coming together, first the U.S. with Five Eyes, the U.S. with NATO, the U.S. with its major non-NATO allies and its friends, to set standards and make investments in capabilities to both responsibly regulate, but also actually build defensive capabilities for that kind of category of unknown threats that exists out there that will continue to emerge. And then second, that doesn't exist in a bubble outside of companies. essentially taking leadership on saying we are at the frontier of these technologies. We will always know more, to be very blunt, we will always know more than the government knows about possible capabilities. And so it has to be a true partnership where the industry should both be self-governing, but also in lockstep with governments that care about making sure that these technologies both are released for amazing economic purpose, but that there are also threats from them, or potentially threats from them, are mitigated. And I would say this is where we feel very strongly, this kind of idea of the defense technology industry having a real moment over the last, 5 or 8 years. I think thinking about what Palantir has done for the data ecosystem, or Anduril's doing in robots, or Shield AI is doing in autonomous, or what Helsing AI is doing in the UK, really taking lessons from that partnership that has sometimes been frictional, sometimes been really productive, but realizing that we have to unlock the power of innovation in our technology sectors if we are going to have the capabilities we need going into this next kind of 10, 20, 30, 50 years. And that is implicitly not just a we serve government, but a partnership with government to help government understand what the requirements need to be and build technologies where to kind of like understand where the puck is going, because we are constantly thinking about what the frontier of that technology is.
Okay, we're going to definitely keep on touching on that because I know that's a big topic that I wanted to go into, which is whole the tech innovation side of biological security firms. But before we go into that, I did want to talk a little bit more about the paper and what you were referencing earlier. So I was sent over and did read through a little bit the new paradigm for threat against biodetection, biological intelligence, BioInt. So this is a little bit of what you were talking about earlier, which is, how do we mitigate threats through detection? I know you went a little bit more in depth about it in the past, but is there anything that we can touch on that you didn't reference or, to explain a little bit more about BioInt? I mean, we know different types of intelligence, human, SIGINT. Why is BioInt special to you?
You let me nerd out for a minute?
Yes, of course.
Okay. So I didn't do a quick background. So after college, I joined the Marine Corps. I was a Marine Corps intelligence officer, served in Iraq. And
You should have
then
said that at the beginning. It's so
that's fine. But the reason I share that is because we actually have to start, and then, kind of we learn about, Marine Corps officers and military officers in general. You kind of learn about domains of operation. You learn about different types of intelligence collection, what functions it serves in the operating environment, et cetera. So then, it's something I've always thought a lot about. But I think what you have to do before you get into BioInt, like SIGINT, like MASINT, like GEOINT, you have to start from what I think is the happening actually at the kind of constructural level of DoD and our national security apparatus. So in the biodefense posture review, the DoD doesn't go quite so far as to say biology should be a domain of operations like cyber, land, air, sea, space. But it does say that near peer adversaries like China, it explicitly says that China has declared biology as a domain of warfare. And China sees biology as the strategic commanding heights of warfare. And so the DoD has gone so far as to say we should pay attention to that. We're not quite ready to call it a domain. I'll come back to why you would want to call it a domain in a second, or not. And then, but it does also then establish a unified group of leaders in DoD that for the first time includes operational leaders, combatant command leaders, thinking about biology, which is like one step short of a unified approach to biology. Now, the nerdy part is, why do we create domains? Like, well, air, land, sea, starting kind of with sea, Alfred Thayer Mahan in the late 1800s, we kind of start thinking about them as domains, not because they didn't exist before. The oceans have always been there. Land has always been there, but because they become accessible via technology in a new way that demands that we operate in them and we understand them as operating terrain. And so the coal-fired ship allowed us to think about the oceans as not just I can only go on the sailing routes, but now I need to think about coal stations and how do I build a different way of thinking about that? And I need to unify how I think about oceans, land, sea. Space has always been there, right? Cyber's a slightly different case, but let's put that aside for a second. Space has always been there. Why wasn't space a domain from the beginning? It is now an operational domain. It has a command. It became a domain because we had rockets, and it became a place for commerce, and thus a place that needed to be secured from a national security standpoint. So the thing about biology is that the operating space that we have to think about is now we understand that it all operates on DNA and RNA, right? And we can now take pictures of it with genetic engineering. We can read and write DNA. We are operating in the biological domain, economically and otherwise. So you have to start from like, should we be thinking about biology as an integrated both opportunity and risk across our entire operating forces? Oh, by the way, we can give tangible examples of US aircraft carriers being shut down by SARS-CoV-2. Like, that is a tangible implication of the biological domain on operating forces. And it's not the last time that will happen. It's not the first time it's happened in history, but we can solve it in different ways. So if you start there, why is that important? Because when you do that, it takes it from, and here's where I'll use the cyber analogy. Cyber used to be the charge of the IT department, right? And I was listening to your conversation, I think with Roderick Jones and Admiral Lefebvre, right? Like, mm-hmm. Think about it. In the 90s, they were talking about counterterrorism. They're like, yeah, we didn't think about cyber. That was just in the 90s. Right, so today we're talking about all of this misinformation, disinformation, computers, et cetera. Who's talking about biology? I promise the fastest advancing technologies on the planet are in bioengineering. And we just lived through this exact thing happening with like us not realizing that cyber was going to impact terrorism. Well, I guarantee that something like that is going to happen. So why do you think about that? Because domains, you create the cyber domain because it pulls it out of the IT department and makes it everybody's concern so that you marshal the resources of national power from political to economic to investment to literally the soldier or marine on the ground thinking about how do I have bioresilience in an operating environment that might have these threats. So you do that, and then if you do that, by definition, you also then need new intelligence collection disciplines. Mm-hmm. So this is where BioInt is, right? Like the idea of BioInt, biointelligence, is that you should have a technical collection discipline like signals intelligence, like MASINT, measurement and signals intelligence, like IMINT. These are technical collection disciplines that allow you to know something about an operating environment that is in a domain that allow you to queue other resources or to inform strategic decision makers of something that is going on. This may not be the most popular comment, but like at the end of the day, it does not really, in my opinion, does not really matter the actual conclusion on where SARS-CoV-2 came from. The simple thing that matters the most is that I think it's the biggest intelligence failure since 1941, which, oh, by the way, is a failure of radar. This is a failure of bioradar and biointelligence, right? It is not whether it was from the Wuhan lab or the wet market, whether it was engineered or not. It's that our $300 billion a year of intelligence community spend, let alone our national security spending, can't inform policymakers with definitive clarity of what happened, so that they can then communicate to a society based on democratic principles that needs to elect leaders based on clear, true information. And instead, it creates a dynamic where it is fodder for argument and distrust and mistrust. And so that, to me, should be the klaxon call for this investment in the technical collection discipline to constantly understand what's happening in the biological environment, so that we can always go back and look and understand what is happening, not so we can pin blame on people, but so that we understand this domain that we are all living in, that is what we are made of. And so that, to me, like, I realize that's the like long arc of it, but like,
no,
it is
I love
the
it.
Most important thing I think we can be thinking about.
Yeah, no, I mean, so much to unpack there. I feel like one of the first kind of questions or just maybe outward thought that I have is trying to understand why it isn't a domain already. I mean, you made so many great arguments. It's what we're made of. Do you think maybe it's because it's just too expansive to fit into one mold and understand? I mean, you talked about accessibility, land, sea, air, space, cyber. It all seems kind of constrained and where you can operate within those. I mean, land, you're operating on land, et cetera. Biology, where, what does that look like? And I mean, I guess, you know, if it were to be a domain and kind of how you envision it, how would we operate within it? How does that look like if it's everywhere around us?
Yeah, no, it's like
Such a
it's a
theoretical question too, I
no.
know.
This is where I want to be really clear on two things. One, from 1971, the Bioweapons Convention, all the way up through to the amazing response that DoD participated in with SARS-CoV-2, there has been a massive investment of amazing human beings building capabilities to defend against and protect us in this domain. Right, so it's not an unknown problem, right? Like this is not a we su suddenly there's a new company in the box that knows how to do it all. No, there's massive expertise. The change moment that has been, it's not like a one day change moment, it's like over a decade, is our ability to be really creative in accessing via technology a foundationally different scale of understanding that thing that you're talking about, which is everything circulating around us, and then taking the conscious decision to say two things. One, for the first time in a history of domains, we are going to declare definitively, at least in the Western world, in the United States of America, that we will be defense only. And we will invest in updating the Bioweapons Convention, and we will invest in defense technologies and recognizing others are pursuing different paths, most likely. We will not fall for that trap. And then two, we have to recognize this is a moment to bring technology to bear in dramatically new ways. And the analogy I like to use, we are not people like you lose it because it feels like such a big problem, especially when your context is like how advanced AI is or how advanced cyber is or how advanced like hypersonic missiles are. Like it's very tangible, right? Oh, and I got to land rockets and I can shoot rockets and all this stuff, like very tangible. But what I try to remind people is like, remember the era we're in. We just invented the moral equivalent of the 1950s era high altitude camera. So with respect to monitoring the Earth and its code, we are in the 1950s, not 2024. And so we need to say, well, how did we start in the 1950s? Well, somebody invented Edwin Land, invented a high altitude camera, and we're like, whoa, cool. We could take pictures from really high of the land. Like, oh, we've just exposed this high fidelity information asset, the land. Well, what is the DNA sequencer today? The DNA sequencer is a camera to take pictures of DNA to expose this new high fidelity information source that literally powers the planet. And what did we do in the 1950s? We were like, oh God, this is too big a problem. Like, unless we can build a always on satellite constellation, we're not even going to start. No, we were like, you know what? Let's build a U-2. We built a damn airplane around a camera. And then the way that that camera worked, it's not like today you get a lot of like, whoa, is that real-time detection? Like, will that immediately solve all problems? No, it won't immediately solve all problems in biodetection. But the U-2, you'd have to like put a guy in a spacesuit, take the plane off, fly it over the Soviet Union, take some pictures, the plane would land. Somebody would have to pull the camera out, probably broke half the time. Somebody goes in a little dark room and develops the film. Then they use a little glass monocle, you know, like look for the missiles. And it's like, is that a missile? I don't know. It's pretty grainy. But then, like, okay, I'm going to analyze if that's a missile and give it to some general. And like 7 days later, you have like a little bit more information about what's going on. But that sparks a revolution in investing and in understanding how the planet is formed. And now you've got satellite weather radar and light and pictures of all different types, right? And so I think that's where we are. And so you have to just start with what is the basics? What is like the U-2 around the camera? And then have like a roadmap for where we want to go with it and the amazing unlock that will be true when you expose this genetic code of the planet. But like recognize it's not going to happen tomorrow. It'll happen faster than the 1950s today because that's just technology convergence. And so like when we think about our airport monitoring programs, I literally talk about it like we are putting a DNA sequencer with a software system that wraps around it so you can just take pictures of a little bit of potentially pathogenic DNA coming off of airplanes that are viruses and bacteria. And it is like, our system is like the U-2 in the 1950s. And we'll keep making it better, obviously, but like that's the mindset you got to put yourself in. So it becomes like a, a problem that you can, it's a bite-sized problem, not a holy cow, where do I even start problem.
And I'm definitely going to ask more about that just because if, I mean, if we're in the 1950s now, where are we going to be in the future? Kind of brings up an exciting possibility and prospects for where that field is going. But before we dive into that, I did want to ask just out of curiosity. So you mentioned that China did make biology, biological, you know, that space as a domain. How does that look like? Is that just from the defense angle, or is that more, you know, how we were discussing earlier, agriculture, critical infrastructure, kind of more economical uses?
No, so I think it's a really great question. So I think the like very fairly, right? Well, since you give me a chance to opine on it, I was at a talk the other day, and I was listening to Jake Sullivan's quotes from his speech at the World Economic Forum, and I thought one of the things that he said that was really of many things actually were very good. I think it was in particular articulate about the situation we're in. How do you deal with strategic competition in an era of interdependence, right? And so that applies to bio too, right? Because with bio, the United States, China, other major nations around the world very clearly see the economic potential of biological engineering. We are making amazing products. And very fairly, if you are a major nation on the planet, frankly, if you are any nation on the planet, you should recognize a need to invest in capabilities around biotechnology, first and foremost, to meet the number one objective of any government, autocratic, democratic, you name it, which is to provide protection and health for your citizens. Biotechnology is going to provide those things. So we should celebrate investment in biotechnology, bioengineering, and we should celebrate everybody trying to do it, right? And so in China's last 5-year plan, biotechnology is hugely prioritized. Right, and that is okay, and then we see their state-owned entity that runs almost all of their biotech work, which is the military associated entity, which I'll come to in a second. But we see them around the world building supply chains for biotechnology for countries everywhere. Now, it is pretty apparent that they have a different set of privacy principles, perhaps ethical principles around human genomic data than we or generally Western governments do, right? And that's something that if you're a country working with BGI, you need to be very aware of. And I think people will increasingly see that if they haven't already. But at the end of the day, the idea that major nation states would be pushing to build supply chains and new creative ways of engineering biology, like that's good. Now, where it becomes the other side of it is, what are you doing in this like kind of game of realpolitik? When you look at these capabilities, are you generating, are you doing things that raise the risk of unintended or intended consequence around bio? And I do think the Biodefense Posture Review, I won't speak out of school, right? Like it very clearly lays out Russia, Iran, North Korea as likely having active programs for bioweapons. And it notes China has very concerning dual-use programs. And so that is a different approach than what we're saying, which is build amazing defensive capabilities, make it the first defense-only domain. And I don't know, you know, maybe if you want to make sure that I answer your question directly, but I think it's very important. People get lost in like the, oh, everything China does is bad narrative a lot. And I do think we are in strategic competition in an era of interdependence. So I think we have to be very eyes wide open, but also recognize there's a lot of good that's coming out of increased global investment in biotechnology.
No, that definitely answered
Does
my
that make any
question.
sense?
Yes, no, it does. It does. I think, you know, again, trying not to fall into under the specter of everything China does is bad. It's hard for people to kind of not perceive a threat. You know, China's doing something and we're not responding to it. We're not doing something of equal posture. So
I just do think on this one, what we need to do is create independence on things like detection and attribution. So this is when we talk about and kind of the idea of bioradar. Really what bioradar is a allied network of detection. And that generates biointelligence, so you know where things came from. And think of it as right now, I don't know if folks remember the pneumonia that came out of China. We didn't really know what was going on. Why? Because like the current system, which is full of amazing people trying to do really good work, is kind of like state-based reporting to the WHO. That is like relying on political solutions to what is actually a mapping of the DNA and RNA of the planet problem. It's a technology problem. So our current biodetection is a political solution to a technology problem. And we need to do a better job of like merging those two things.
Well,
And we shouldn't be reliant
politics,
on waiting,
anything
right? We shouldn't be reliant on waiting for reporting from any other country. This is my personal opinion. We should, as the United States of America that spends $1.3 trillion a year on our national security infrastructure, not rely on other places to know what or how bad something is.
importance of bio, and that's what we're learning from
That's
this
it.
conversation. But I did want to ask, what's the like what does the analysis side of bioint look like? So we talked a little bit about collection, we made that analogy towards kind of spatial awareness in the 1950s and under, being able to take pictures from above. How do you all, I suppose, in your roles, analyze what's coming in through biointelligence means of collection?
Yeah, this is a it's like it's a very cool problem actually, right? Because you have classes, you have to start with like there's classes of questions that need to be answered, right? There's kind of like the big questions of are people building bioweapons? Has somebody released like is that new thing? Is that genetically engineered? These are like the big national security questions. And then there's like a set of questions below that, which are where do we think and how do we monitor for things that might naturally emerge? That starts to merge much more into kind of an environmental surveillance, global health, public health question, same tech stack, right? And so there's still biointelligence. And I'm talking about the technical collection discipline of actually collecting environmental samples and turning them into a data problem. That's the bioradar system doing that. But then there's a massive amount of other data out there in the digital surveillance landscape that informs what you want to be analyzing about intentions, about actual activities, about things that are happening, especially before you have persistent, pervasive, always on actual wet collection and detection. And so it's a big problem. I think where we feel like the right place to start is essentially baseline mapping. Like, we haven't even started with, and then there's kind of two things, baseline mapping. So that's why we love the airport idea. Humans travel through airports, pathogens travel with humans on airplanes. And what we're working really hard on, and we have active programs right now in the United States, in Ukraine, in Qatar, in Rwanda, in Botswana, and a number of other MOUs we've announced. We're actively working on building a network of countries who we serve directly as the biosecurity provider for those countries, who then also share information on a common platform to be able to get essentially a map of how are pathogens moving around the world. And then what that allows you to start doing is early warning. So we, for example, just in the US airport program, we found BA2, which was one of the subvariants of Omicron when it first came out, 42 days before it showed up clinically in a hospital. And that just gives 42 days extra alert on something bad happening. Well, you might want 180 days. You also might want maximum time. But at the end of the day, think about what we have now. If you get 42 days, we have mRNA vaccines. If it's something really bad, now you're starting to push not from, oh, we found it in maybe October, November of 2019, and we had vaccines by the next December, to, oh, maybe you find it in October, November, and you have vaccines by February. That changes the nature of things. So the bioint, like the so what piece, is constantly building on foundation, then early warning, and then ultimately you'll be able to trace things back to where they came from. You'll be able to immediately characterize them to create interventions very rapidly. And I can, if we want to go into it further, we have a very cool program that's launching in Rwanda to essentially do what people think about as the 100-day detection to mitigation mission, but in one country. So we're going to run a trial. BioNTech just launched an mRNA vaccine manufacturing facility. We run an airport surveillance program in Rwanda, and we're going to do a trial of how, like, can you detect and then put it into a process to make a vaccine in one country within 100 days?
That's
Sounds
really cool.
crazy, and it sounds crazy in bioland, but like that's like the norm in cyber. Countries have their own infrastructure to detect and patch threats when they come under attack. Seems
Yeah,
right.
it just seems more complicated. But I
Yeah.
mean, it's
Remember
crazy how
how
much it can
complicated
do.
cyber seemed? Cyber seemed like mind blowing for people. We just solve it because we're humans. We're like good at
Yeah.
technology. That's the moment we're in. You just gotta have to
Wow.
like, this is why I really, really, really love the idea of what SpaceX has said. We want to put humans on Mars and have them live there. That seems complicated. And they're like, yep. And you know what we're gonna do? We're gonna lay out a 30-year master plan, plus or minus. And you're gonna know what we're gonna start with. We're gonna land a rocket. Because we know we need to reduce the cost of rocketry. And then we're gonna design a cargo capsule, but we're gonna design it to the standard of a human capsule. So we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Because we know to get here, we have to do these things. So the same idea exists. You just have to break it into these problems, the smaller problems, and say, all right, we're gonna do airport detection. We realize it doesn't solve the whole problem. But eventually, you'll get
Eventually
there.
something, yeah, breakthrough will come. I am so sad we only have 7 minutes left because this kind of goes into a conversation or a topic that I'm sure you can spend hours talking about, which is just innovations in biotechnology. What are we seeing? So you just spoke a little bit about that. What else is Ginkgo doing?
Yeah, I think the like most exciting stuff, right? So as I mentioned before, and what I love about Ginkgo, as I mentioned, 1,200 people, like 300,000 square feet of automated labs. What I love about, like one of the major things I love about it is we've really taken this approach to say we believe and we will drive as the platform company for bioengineering, this amazing kind of post-scarcity future based on like bioengineered products. And that's everything from medicines to food. And just like when computers were invented, a new industry needed to exist called cybersecurity. And so we are going to build, we have little b biosecurity because we believe it should be an umbrella for an industry of technology companies that are building capabilities across this very complex surface that you're talking about, how hard a problem it is for different things at different times. And so we get to do that, both of those things inside of Ginkgo. And what I would say is the two most exciting things that are going on are certainly this concept of teaching AI to read DNA, right? And I'll break that down into like my history major understanding from the other great benefit of working at Ginkgo is you get to just talk to amazing human beings at all times. Here's the deal, right? We taught AI to read the human language. Like, or in human languages. Human languages are invented by humans. They're super complex. We have all sorts of specialty uses of them, legal, healthcare. And like, I don't know, GPT-4, Claude 2, like pretty long, very good at essentially being like, I don't know, 90% of the way there. We taught AI to read something we invented that is super complex. DNA, okay, so DNA, like a little nerdy for a second, right? DNA is four letters that make up all, like four letters that signify chemicals that make up all living things on the planet. And they make amino acids. And there's essentially a number of amino acids. There are only 18 meanings for the amino acids. There's only 18 definitions in the dictionary. So like the Merriam-Webster dictionary has a lot of definitions. The dictionary of amino acids that make proteins that are building blocks for our life. And yes, a lot of stuff happens later that's very complicated. We won't figure it all out right now. That's why we need AI. The point is, there's like 18, basically 18 definitions. And then two more stop codons, like blah. So it is definitively clear in my, like the hypothesis, and this is what needs to be tested by tons of companies, Ginkgo included, that we're going to be able to teach AI to read biology, to read DNA way faster than humans can figure it out. Because what we're doing is essentially taking an alien language, right? We invented the human language. We didn't invent DNA. That came from somewhere crazy. but it runs all human life. And we are saying, let's train the AI model that this sequence makes this protein that has this activity. And remember, digital physical interface, you have to be able to print it out and see what it does. So if you train and label that data and you do it at massive scale, why wouldn't we hypothetically be able to then just start having AI give us a string of letters for a specific function that we want a living thing to produce in a way that we don't know how it's thinking? We've just given it the data on both sides, the wet label data and the letters that signify that, and have an amazing explosion in innovation in medicine and productive products. And obviously you can then turn that on detection of bad things too. And so that's, I think that's the most exciting thing. And we're like, as a company, just like massively expanding into, as you might imagine, biopharma and biotech with that as like the core thing, because it just changes. This is the point. It like fundamentally changes our ability to provide collectively our ability to do amazing things in human health.
Yeah.
So that's probably what I'm most like as a company and as like a world, I'm most excited about, like that productive AI bio acceleration. And then the exhaust is what we can use those tools to build defensive capabilities.
In 20 or 30 years, where do you want to see these capabilities? I know it's a long time, but I feel like it'll come by.
Yeah. Like, I think
like if you were saying like, oh, back in 2024, that those are like the 1950s in terms of what we can do, where would we be at that point in time?
So I'll give you two answers on one on the, like my life that I live daily in the biosecurity side. We should be able to monitor every node on the planet at all times where a potential bio threat could emerge from, persistently, pervasively, always on. When something is collected and turned into a data stream, we should have AI tools, AI reading DNA, immediately identifying and characterizing anything that poses potential threat to human, plant, or animal life, not 5 days later, immediately flagging that, and then automatically using the tools that I just mentioned, automatically designing the mitigation required, whether that's a vaccine or a therapeutic, or even just a change human behavior, this is how the system should adjust, and then flagging that to either immediate manufacturing, human in the loop only for observation and approval, remote distributed manufacturing. We have DARPA programs today working on how to make vaccines and therapeutics remote distributed so that actually it acts like cyber. And all of those pieces of that technology puzzle, and this is where I look at it. When I look at innovation, I look at who's building capabilities in each of those steps and how do we integrate that into the infrastructure layer? Just like we do with any software product, you deploy a system and you continually upgrade it. Just like you do in, it's not a platform-centric system, which is obviously what we're used to buying. It is very much a continually upgradable system. So I think 30 years from now, we shouldn't worry about infectious disease or bio threats because we've built the equivalent of what we have in cyber. And I know our time, the other one that I really love, folks talk about, and Sam Altman talks about this a lot, we're going into a world of free intelligence, free energy, right? At some point, fusion's going to work. And then essentially everything else we have makes free energy. So if you have free intelligence, free energy, and you've eliminated infectious disease slash then chronic disease because you're building amazing tools of biotech, both on the defensive and productive side, is that post-scarcity? Like, how does that change how we as humans get to unlock ourselves with our time and creativity and amount of years on the planet? We don't have, like, the things that restrain us, energy, intelligence, and health, are now free, right? It's not crazy to imagine that, like, post-scarcity, very beautiful future happening, and we will have lots of political problems to solve. We have lots of new systems and structures to figure out. We have to figure out how to make that all equitable across not just crazy, insane, rich people, but also all the way down to, you know, people at the very, very bottom of the human pyramid, right? Like, this is... Those are going to be the challenges in my mind in the next 20 and 30 years.
Wow. Well, thank you, Matt, so much. I really love this conversation. If you have any books, podcasts, or documentaries, I always want to learn more about stuff like this. So
yeah, we'll send stuff over. Thanks, Andrea.